Long ago in the back dark mists of time. Badil Garbi has made his first code contribution to what we call the free software community in 1979 and has been using and developing Unix-like systems since 1982. Badil has two BS degrees, one was obviously insufficient, from CMU, and has worked for HP or HP's spin-off Agilent Technologies since 1986. He joined the Debian project in 94 and remains active today in a number of roles in the Debian community. You were like in charge of Debian for a while, weren't you?
Yes, Debian project leader for a while.
Debian project leader for a while. By day, Badil is HP's open source and Linux CTO. By night, he builds pieces of amateur satellites in his basement. So without further ado, Badil Garbi.
Thanks a lot. Is this mic working okay? I can't tell very well from here. You got me? Great, good. Okay, cool. So this is one of those neat opportunities. I spent a lot of time talking at various events about Linux and open source things and you know, why HP ended up being the number one vendor in that marketplace and all that sort of thing. It's actually fun for me to get a chance to give a talk at a conference like this about the other part of my life, which is my hobby passion. I've been involved in the amateur radio community since about 1984 and playing around with amateur satellites as a user since 85 or so, and helping to build them since not long after that. And what I'm going to try and do today is tell you a little bit about what this is all about. And because this is a Usenix conference, I'm going to focus on the role of computing on the various amateur satellites through history. I'll try and show you sort of how this has evolved over time and some of the challenges that we're trying to address right now for future missions. But really, above all, what I want to do is give you sort of a flavor for what this amateur satellite thing is all about. I think it's really exciting, and I've had fun over the last few years drawing parallels between the things that happen in the open source community and the things that happen in the amateur satellite community, because both are communities where unreasonably cool things have come out of mostly volunteer contributions. So what is an amateur satellite? Well, it's a non-commercial amateur radio satellite. These are satellites that are built and operated by volunteers. This is a hobby for me. I don't get paid for doing it. I would not put this many thousands of hours into something I was getting paid for. just ask my boss. They often also end up being a platform for interesting scientific experiments. It's interesting how many bright people in universities have an idea for something little that they'd like to try, if only they had a way to put that little something up in orbit and communicate with it and get telemetry back from it afterwards. So there's been a really wonderful collaboration over the last 30-plus years between the amateur radio community building and launching satellites and folks in the scientific community. The way we structure all this is we have this worldwide group of organizations made up of mostly amateur radio operators, though there are lots of other folks that are interested in what we do and support this activity by being members and paying $30 a year or whatever the dues are to get the newsletter and to be contributing sponsors of the work that we're doing. In AMSAT North America, in North America, there's this 501c3 nonprofit corporation called AMSAT NA. That's based in Silver Springs, Maryland, and that's the sort of donations gathering entity for providing the financial resources we need to do this work. And it's also the organization that provides the structure around these activities. But frankly, it's just an uber geeky way to spend my spare hobby time. And just to give you a sense, this is one of our satellites, that thing in the middle in the tuna can. It's a big tuna can. That was Oscar 40. The biggest, baddest amateur satellite ever built and launched. You get a sense of the physical scale there, on the order of 680 kilograms at launch, a tremendous amount of communications capability. It had a rough life. We had some propulsion system problems with that little thruster there in the middle with the big remove before flight thing hanging off of it. This satellite actually sustained a propulsion system explosion on orbit and went on to have a very useful service life of several years. So I think that's kind of cool. That design for redundancy and design for failure stuff really does work if you're good at it. And the two little cube satellites on the side are actually microsatellites designed by a defense research group in the UK that actually used a bunch of technical ideas and principles that came out of some of the amateur satellites that went before. And you'll see how that all sort of came together as I go through the talk. What does it take to use these things? Well, anybody can listen. These are transmitting in the clear, unencrypted. A lot of them use analog communications. Some of them use digital communications. It's quite possible to listen to some of the low Earth orbiting satellites with nothing more than a police scanner. But if you want to transmit signals to these satellites, you've got to have an amateur radio license. The neat thing is in the U.S., you only need to have the entry-level license to do everything you could ever want to do, almost, with amateur satellites. And that no longer requires Morse code to get that level of license and all those sorts of things. So the barrier to entry for playing with amateur satellites is actually pretty low. The high-orbit satellites, the ones that I get the biggest zing out of, are a little more sophisticated to interact with. That antenna stack is the previous one used by a friend of mine out in Indiana. And if you kind of stare at that for a minute, you'll realize they're about five long Yagis with, you know, 10 or 12 foot booms and about one, two, three separate dish reflectors all made out of mesh things. And this was operating at the time on, I guess, five different frequency bands. I've got, you know, equally complicated things laying around in my backyard. So what's interesting about computing environments on amateur satellites? Well, the environment of space is actually sort of surprisingly benign, with some exceptions. When I say surprisingly benign, the temperatures aren't all that extreme. With good thermal design on our spacecraft, the stuff tends to run in the sort of 0 to 25 degrees C range, which is, you know, pretty normal for electronics here on Earth. There aren't typically, you know, too many weird constraints. Volume and mass are always issues, but those are not issues that are unfamiliar to people working on mobile and portable devices. Power production and availability is an issue, but again, that's not a big surprise for people building mobile and portable devices here on Earth. The things that are different are, first of all, radiation. When you get outside of the Earth's atmosphere, you get to deal with ionizing radiation in a big way. By far the most common events are these things called single event upsets, where a single ionizing particle hits a bit of memory and applies some energy to the charge storage structure in the integrated circuit or whatever that piece of component is, and causes the state of a bit to flip. And these are pretty ugly, but guess what? We know how to deal with these things pretty well here on Earth. A lot of your servers now have error correcting memories. Where, in effect, there's more bits per word than are really needed to store the data, so that there's some redundancy there, and they can correct single bit and detect double bit errors and things like that. We do the same thing on our spacecraft. All of our memory systems use extra bits to do error correcting codes, and we have little wash algorithms that run in the background to make sure that every location in memory gets accessed and those defects get detected and corrected often enough that they don't accumulate and you end up with lots of bad bits in the same word. There's also really interesting, you know, discussions you can get into about memory architectures where you'd really like separate integrated circuits to represent each of the bits in a given word so that a single hit on a single chip doesn't cause lots of bits in the same word to all get affected at the same time and so forth. One of the problems with single event upsets is that most microprocessor designs don't include any error correction or detection in their on-chip memories or in their caches or in their registers. And as a result, these things can be a problem even if your external memory is well protected. You have to have watchdog mechanisms and things like that to cover for that. Latch-ups are theoretically possible. This is where a similar particle impact causes an SCR to be formed in the base structure of the semiconductor, and that can cause a huge amount of current to be flowing in places where no current is expected to flow. In effect, an insulating layer ends up acting like a conductor. These are hideously bad if they ever happen. Unfortunately, they're almost impossible to detect. They're very difficult to design in a useful circuitry for unless you're willing to do a complete power off and power back on of the device. And that's really hard to do with the processor that's your principal housekeeping processor. So the good news is we've never actually seen one of these in the wild in Earth orbit. And the other good thing that's happening is that as integrated circuits move to lower and lower core voltages, we're getting down to the point where there isn't enough voltage in the structure to maintain an SCR if one is formed like this. So actually, we're the beneficiaries of the slow march of technology here. As core voltages get down into the 1 volt range, you can't form an SCR, in the base structure, and it just isn't an issue anymore. A silicon-controlled rectifier. It's basically a diode that gets turned on by some external piece of energy. Think of it as a conduction path through what should otherwise be an insulator, meaning all of a sudden you got like a dead short in a place where you would prefer not to have one. The real problem with latch-ups is that if you sink enough current through there, you can actually cause permanent damage to the part. And again, you know, we've never seen one in the wild, so hope we never do. Cumulative dose damage is a problem, particularly for structures that have capacitive things in integrated circuits. So for example, lots of microcontrollers these days take a very low frequency watch crystal or something as an input, then have a phase lock loop circuit with some capacitors in the IC structure. And as those capacitors accumulate dose, their values change and the circuits stop working. The consequence is that lots of little microcontroller chips, the first thing that you notice failing is that the console serial port baud rate is moving far enough that you can't listen to it anymore. Another constraint is vacuum. All of the heat that's generated has to be conducted or radiated away. There's no such thing as putting a fan in there. You can tell university students who haven't quite wrapped their brain around this, because they'll come and show things at conferences and you go, what's that over there? It's the fan. Yeah, right. And of course, there's no service calls. Once it's launched, it's gone. So you have to design things so that they're self-sustaining and reasonably autonomous, or you're in trouble. So AMSAT does all sorts of interesting things to try and meet those constraints and yet do it with essentially zero budget. Lots of these pieces are built in garages and basements. You'll see a couple of pictures of things happening in my basement just to prove the point. Lots of leftover donated and surplus parts used. We've also discovered that there are lots of ways that you can use commercially rated parts and test them as opposed to buying more expensive military or space-rated parts. A good example of this is NiCad batteries. Rechargeable batteries. Turns out the same battery design is used for commercial products, for medical products, and for space-rated and military-rated products. The only difference is how much work the manufacturer does to qualify those parts. Well, if you've got an X-ray machine and a couple of volunteers who are willing to sit around with power supplies and meters to characterize the performance of each cell, you can build known good, well-matched battery packs by buying a case of the medically rated batteries, which are about an order of magnitude cheaper than the space rated ones. It's probably worth not going into the commercial stuff because, you know, I don't know. There's a trade-off in there somewhere. Medical batteries from China don't cost much and other things do. Another good example is a lot of people ask us why we don't use mil-spec parts for all of the integrated circuits and so forth. Mil-spec basically means they've been tested within an inch of their life and they didn't fail. It turns out we believe that a better strategy is to buy the commercial parts and test them ourselves in the process of building and integrating a spacecraft. And if they're still good to go at launch, then great, and we haven't stressed them within an inch of their life at any point in the process. We also use things like flexible, you know, Stanley steel measuring tapes for antennas. It's wonderful stuff. It's light. If it gets bent somehow, it snaps back. We've actually taken advantage of that to like coil a piece of it up and put a piece of string around it and have a little pyro device to cut the string so the antenna will go zing and flip itself out. Things like bar magnets for passive attitude stabilization. You've heard of the Earth's magnetic field, right? If you get the bar magnets lined up in the right direction, you can actually cause a small satellite to align itself with the Earth's magnetic field. And doing things like, you know, painting alternate sides of these measuring tapes white and black will cause the satellite to spin from solar pressure on the antenna blades, the same way those little radiometer things that you could get for your desk would do. This stuff really works. You know, physics is a wonderful thing. We've had fiberglass mounting rails that were cured in the kitchen oven of an AMSAT VP's house. And yes, he's still married, but involved buying a new oven. and some thermal blankets, which are, you know, generally perceived to be super high-tech things that you put on the outside of spacecraft, were hand-sewn by AMSAT volunteers using some donated materials. So how did all this stuff get started? And, you know, how do we start doing this? Well, back in 1957, and no, I'm not that old, but I can read history, Russia really shocked the world when they launched Sputnik 1. It was the first man-made Earth-orbiting satellite. And frankly, you know, as various movies have depicted and so forth, this was a relatively scary event for folks in North America and in the rest of the so-called free world at that time. Not long afterwards, the U.S. launched Explorer 1, which was the first successful American launch of a man-made Earth-orbiting satellite. But what really blows me away is on the 12th of December, 1961, barely 4 years after Sputnik, amateur radio operators in the United States successfully launched an orbital satellite carrying amateur radio, or OSCAR. And that kicked off this whole thing. And since then, we're up to, I think, 53 successful satellites that have made it into orbit. Now, we don't actually build the launch vehicles. That's a misconception. I'm not a rocket scientist. I'm just a spacecraft scientist. These have almost all gone as secondary payloads on commercial or military launch vehicles. And again, I'll talk about that some more as we go through. This is a picture of one of the engineering prototypes of OSCAR-1 sitting in the grass in somebody's backyard to get its picture taken. The reason I put it there is you can see there are a couple little switches on there and a spring. That spring was $1.25 at Sears. And that was the release and detachment mechanism. This is a better picture of, this one's actually of OSCAR-2. OSCAR-1 and OSCAR-2 were very similar. In this case, you see there's a single whip antenna made out of a piece of piano wire coming out of the top of it. And all that shiny stuff is material that was put on to affect the emissivity of this so that there'd be some thermal control. This was a really impressive accomplishment. In fact, what I want to do now is let you hear what this sounded like. Other way. Doesn't sound like very much, right? Well, it turns out there was one telemetry channel on the spacecraft, and it controlled the speed at which that was sent, and that was proportional to the temperature on the spacecraft. It wasn't quite exactly what they expected it to be. It turns out that if you slow that down by a factor of two and apply some filtering to get rid of some of the background noise, this is what it sounds like. Can you hear that? Sort of four dots followed by two dots. Does anybody know enough Morse code to know what that means? It's the letters H and I. Yeah, laughing at you. No, that's a more modern interpretation. It was actually a really friendly satellite compared to this image everybody had of Sputnik up there, you know, going deep, deep, sounding like a bomb ticking away. To get back to this notion of computing, the things that you need to do on an amateur satellite where computing plays a role starts with housekeeping. It's this whole issue of power management, battery charge regulation. Of course, you want telemetry. I mentioned that on OSCAR-1, it was really simple. It was generating a two-character Morse code sequence where the speed at which that was being sent was proportional to the temperature on a spacecraft. Not very sophisticated, yet pretty cool. We have much more sophisticated telemetry systems now. And on the more sophisticated satellites, like OSCAR-40 that I showed, the processing and the housekeeping is also important for doing navigation, understanding which way the spacecraft is oriented, where it is in its orbit, so that you can do appropriate resource scheduling. So you know when to take a picture with a camera, when to switch transmitters into different modes, and so forth. There are also, as I mentioned earlier, some interesting scientific experiments that have been flown, and controlling those experiments often involves the use of some kind of onboard microprocessor. I'll show you a couple examples of that later. And we're now building really advanced communication systems that where the modulation and demodulation would be difficult to accomplish if we didn't have software-defined radio techniques at work, and where, particularly as we talk about some of the things that we're going to be moving to in the future in one of the upcoming missions, lots and lots of forward error correction is really, really important for being able to maintain contact with these spacecraft at really large distances. So the earliest satellites really had little or no onboard control. They were sort of passive objects with analog circuitry in them. OSCAR-1, as I mentioned, it was significant because it was the first amateur satellite. It was also the first secondary payload ever launched on a rocket. The beacon speed, as I mentioned, was proportional to the temperature. Weighed about 10 pounds, lasted about 22 days before the batteries croaked. And 570 hams in 28 countries reported hearing it and provided recordings or timing information about what they'd heard in the telemetry stream. OSCAR-2 is very similar, a few minor improvements. OSCAR-3 was the first satellite that carried an actual transponder that amateur radio folks could use to communicate with each other. It was a 50 kilohertz transponder in band in the what we now call the 2 meter amateur radio band with a 1 watt transmitter. That transmitter ran for about 18 days, and during that time over 1,000 hams in 22 countries made contacts using it. Blows me away. Pretty impressive stuff. This was also the first amateur satellite to carry solar cells so that it could recharge the batteries on board. Weighed about 16 kilos, and the beacons on it, the telemetry beacons, continued to operate for a couple months after the transponder stopped. I think Oscar 4 is interesting because these guys were aggressive. Not long after Oscar 3, they built a satellite that was intended for geostationary orbit. Now, it wouldn't have, I don't know exactly how well it would have worked if it had gotten there, but unfortunately we'll never know because the upper stage of the launch vehicle sort of failed, putting that into an unexpected orbit. And so the most significant thing we can say about Oscar 4 is it was the first example of a satellite that kind of got to orbit but didn't go where we expected, where the amateur radio community got to go into recovery mode and try and figure out what had happened and what they could do with it. Moving ahead a little bit, Oscar 6 is interesting for the purposes of this talk because it was the first satellite that had a quote-unquote complex control system using discrete logic. It was actually capable of receiving commands and changing the state of the satellite based on that. It was also the first Phase 2 satellite. Phase 1 satellites were really low Earth orbit. All of the satellites prior to Oscar 6 and some of the more recent university projects fall into this category. They have limited expected lifetimes because of that. Phase 2 satellites are still low Earth orbit, but they're in higher orbits that are more stable over a longer period of time. And as a result, the Oscar 6 was the first satellite that was designed to have a fairly significant operational lifetime. It was about 16 kilos launched in October of 72. Oscar 7 is just an amazing story. This is the oldest currently operational amateur satellite. It was launched in November of 1974. It was the first time a battery charge regulator was used on an amateur satellite. It was also the first time the high-efficiency linear adaptive, I can't remember what HELAP stands for, but it's an interesting technique of intentionally distorting the transmit waveform before you feed it into the transmitter so that you get maximum efficiency out of the power amplifier stages. Really great for voice, really hideous for data. Enough said. In 1981, the batteries on this spacecraft failed. And we actually, from the telemetry that was received, are pretty sure that what happened was that each cell individually failed in a shorted mode. And so over time, the string of batteries' voltage dropped to the point where the electronics wouldn't operate anymore. But in 2002, an amateur radio station tuning around the band heard some interesting, familiar-sounding noises and investigated, and lo and behold, the best we can guess is that at some point enough current was being dumped through that string of batteries that something sort of popped like a fuse and opened up, and now that satellite is functional again, moderately controllable, and it works fine as long as it's in sunlight. It has a really sensitive receiver and a really strong transmitter, and when it's behaving nicely, it's a really fun satellite to use. I resemble that remark. This is Oscar 7, and that's Jan King, one of the longtime contributors to the amateur satellite community. In fact, he's re-engaged now and helping on one of our upcoming projects. One of the neatest people I've ever had the opportunity to work with. And what he's attaching Oscar 7 to here is a vibration table. Because one of the things you have to do before you're allowed to latch these things up to a launch vehicle is make sure that when they're shaken, they won't fall apart and mess up everything else. Oscar 9. Oscar 9 was built at the University of Surrey in the UK and was actually the second satellite that they built. But it's significant in this sort of history because it was the first time there was a microprocessor used in this integrated housekeeping role, which has become a mainstay of the amateur satellite architecture since then. It's kind of interesting, though, because it wasn't actually a ham radio communication satellite. It used very similar designs and technology, but it carried various scientific and educational payloads, was used to demonstrate communications capabilities for health and relief workers in odd corners of the world and so forth. But the fact that it was the first one that actually used a microprocessor for that central housekeeping function is pretty significant. And then kind of skip a few and talk about this series of Phase 3 satellites. At some point, somebody pointed out that the problem with all these amateur satellites is in these low orbits, the time that they spent over any given point on the Earth in a single pass was on the order of 15 to 30 minutes. And that's fun, but it's not great for having long conversations and so forth. And the Russians had a problem where Geosynchronous satellites didn't work all that well for them, particularly for TV things, because from far northern latitudes, the geostationary satellite belt is pretty low to the horizon. It's not like here in the U.S. where the dishes are kind of pointed up. There, they're pointed like really close to the horizon. So somebody observed that if you put satellites into an elliptical orbit that was inclined from the equator 60-odd degrees, there's a pretty stable orbit, and the satellite would come up over the horizon, go up and sort of hang in a particular portion of the sky as it was going out along the ellipse, do a little translation as it went around the far end of the ellipse, and then hang in about the same point in the sky as it came back in on the long arm of the ellipse. So if you could get the orbit timing just right, you could aim your antenna at the apogee point, and within the beam width of that antenna, the satellite would sort of appear to just hang there. And of course, its signal strength would vary as it went out and came back, but that's just an engineering issue. It's not a big deal. And so this is what the Russians for a long time used for things like TV and other communication satellites. And some hams looked at it and said, that's pretty cool. We can have a satellite that goes up, kind of hangs there for a long time. We can have good communications through it. If we get the apogee altitude just right, we can cover almost half of the Earth at one time, so we can have long-distance communications and so forth. And so they set out and built a series of these Phase 3 satellites. Unfortunately, Phase 3A ended up on the bottom of the Atlantic due to an Ariane booster failure. Phase 3B was built as a clone of it very quickly and became Oscar 10 after its launch in 1983. However, because it was built quickly as a replacement for Phase 3A, there wasn't the budget around to buy really expensive components like static RAM. And so that actually flew with dynamic RAM on the housekeeping unit. If you know anything about RAM designs and electronics, the problem with dynamic RAMs is they have capacitive charge storage structures in them. And so not surprisingly, after about 3 years, the IHU failed because the memory had accumulated so much radiation it just didn't function anymore. Wonderfully, that satellite was designed so that when the IHU failed, the transponders were typically left in a reasonable operating mode. And so that satellite, again, continues to be up there. Its operation is now super erratic to the point of almost not being useful. But for many years, that satellite was an absolutely wonderful satellite when it was in sunlight. There was no charge management going on. There's no stabilization management, but on the omnidirectional antennas, it was a wonderful satellite. I kind of cut my teeth on Oscar 10 from a user standpoint. Phase 3C, which was a similar mechanical structure, similar electronics design, slightly upgraded communications electronics, was launched in June of 1988, and it operated marvelously. That was a really beautiful satellite in this particular series. Unfortunately, the exact orbit it ended up in had various perturbations due to second and third order effects from the gravitational effects of the planets. And that caused it to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere and burn up on the 5th of December in 1996. Now, the cool part about this, hot part, cool part, is that a lot of work was done on analyzing the orbit dynamics to figure out what was going on. The re-entry date was predicted to within about a day or so by James Miller in the UK, one of the command stations. There's some discussion about whether he actually hit the orbit or whether he was off by one orbit. But towards the end, our ability to understand the heating that was occurring as this thing started to impact the upper atmosphere during the perigee part of the orbit was really neat, and they were actually able to figure out from the changes they were observing in the orbit as the orbit started to collapse just how much heat it was being induced on it due to friction on each of these perigee passes. And watching it in the last day or so was stunning, because on a particular perigee, one of the solar panels failed, probably because the solder joints and the wires melted. On the next perigee, all but one of the solar panels failed. And on the next perigee, the last panel went about 18, 20 minutes later, it stopped transmitting, because the batteries were well and truly cooked by that point. We learned a lot from this satellite. And in fact, this particular mechanical structure is coming back, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. This is what that satellite looked like, to give you a sense of scale. Had a couple of analog transponders, about 150 kilograms at launch. And it's Werner Haas and on the left, and Carl Meinzer, who at the time was the president of AMSAT-DL, on the right. And the guy in the middle is I forget what his name is. He's the guy from ESA who was responsible for approving the integration of the spacecraft onto the launch vehicle. One other little detail is that this was launched on the first test launch of an Ariane 4 booster. One of the other payloads that was on there was this thing called PanAmSat. Remember that when I get a little further along. PanAmSat, by the way, that was the first satellite launched by the company that came to be known as PanAmSat. And they bet the farm on that satellite. If it hadn't worked, they wouldn't have had a business. And they ended up having a really big business. So just to give you a sense of what these Phase 3 satellites were like, let me play a little audio clip of somebody. What this audio clip is of a guy sitting there transmitting to Oscar 10. And you'll also hear the return echoes coming back with a little bit of a delay. You know, the round-trip time to the satellite. It'll give you a sense of what it was like using this when it was working well.
On Oscar 10, testing 1, 2, 3, 4, WZO SL, testing and clear.
So, I mean, there's a bunch of static there, but if you've ever been around folks making amateur radio contacts, or if you are yourself a ham, that's not bad. I mean, HF on a good day is, you know, not often that good. Okay, so back to the whole computing thing. The Phase 3 satellites had an IHU design that has lived for a really long time. How many of you remember the RCA 1802 Cosmac Elf series? Yeah, me too. My first computer was an 1802. Popular Electronics, 1974. Four. Oh, God.
Are we that old?
Yeah, we are that old. See? The memory sizes, I mean, just to give you a sense, this is an 8-bit microprocessor with what we today would call a RISC instruction set, very simple instruction set, an orthogonal 16-bit registers. All the instructions were orthogonal across all of those registers. For those of us who started with that processor, nothing else was worth touching until the 68000 came along. Z80s, they were junk. 8080s, you knew were junk. You know, all these weird registers and weird instructions that, you know, you couldn't use that one on this register. You know, I admit I was permanently, you know, altered by my experience with this processor, I think in a good way. The memory sizes, the early ones, I think 16K was the first one. It might have been 8K. I'm not entirely sure. But by the time of Oscar 40, it was flying with a whopping 64K bytes of RAM, never more than about 33K of which was ever used. And on Oscar 40, that was actually all RadHard, which I'll talk about later. The flight software for all of the Phase 3 satellites has been based on this thing called IPS that Carl Meinzer designed. He heard a talk in the early days of Forth about this threaded interpretive language idea, but he didn't like Forth. There were things about Forth that he thought were really limiting. So he went off, you know, quote unquote, in a vacuum and designed this thing called IPS. And until about 3 years ago, he would tell you just, you know, ad nauseum, why IPS was so different from Forth and so much better than Forth, unaware of the fact that in, you know, that same period of time, the Forth folks had figured out some of the same issues. It's actually a lot more like Forth today than you'd believe. It implemented a really efficient 16-bit stack-oriented virtual machine with cooperative multitasking on these 8-bit CPUs. And to give you a sense, the 1802 is running at about 100 kilo instructions per second. While satellites are moving really fast, things that you need to do actually happen very slowly. The conditions they're operating in don't tend to change dramatically unless something's really wrong. The basic timer tick behind this cooperative multitasker was 20 milliseconds. That's 50 hertz, which is the line frequency in Europe. And yeah, there's a reason it was that. And 400 bit per second for the telemetry and command links is really simple. If you take 50 hertz and 8 bits, well, you get it. Lots of things like that about IPS. For example, the way commercial satellite operators describe the position in the orbit is to talk about a number between 0 and 359 representing the portion of the circle that's been swept out by the arc between the center of the Earth and the satellite. In AMSAT, we use 0 to 255. For no good reason except that it computes a lot faster on an 8-bit CPU. So then, sort of along in parallel, really, with the Phase 3 satellite history, AMSAT got involved in these things called microsats. Until that time, nobody had ever thought that a satellite as small as a 9-inch cube could do something useful. But we built a bunch of these, and in January of 1990, we launched four of them on the same launch vehicle, along with two satellites from University of Surrey. And what they contained was a transmitter, five receivers. If you've ever read the Aloha papers from the networking universe, you understand why five makes sense, because it turns out that if you're on a network where there's no ability to detect anybody else, there's no collision detection and no obvious collision avoidance mechanisms, 4-to-1 is a pretty good ratio of receivers to transmitters to keep the transmitter busy. And of course, you wanted a fifth one for command uplink that wasn't published. These had battery charge regulators. They used an NEC V40 CPU, which is kind of an 8088 clone with a lot of integrated I.O. So in effect, what these were sort of a PC bulletin board in orbit. People could upload messages, sort of email kinds of things, files, and download them. And then each satellite also had this thing called a TSFR, the This Space for Rent module. And each of those four satellites had a different something put in there to make them all interesting and unique. Oscar 16 had an S-band or 2.4 gigahertz transmitter designed by Matyaj Vidmar. Number 18 from the WeberSat had a camera built in and took pictures. 17 was Dove and had a voice synthesizer. I don't actually remember what was in 19. This design, this Microsat design, had an incredible lifetime within the amateur satellite community. About half of the satellites built to date are either this exact design or very close derivatives of it. And frankly, it spawned an entire small satellite industry. Lots of the things that have happened since the Iridium constellation is pretty much a direct descendant. This notion that you could have lots of little satellites as opposed to one or two big ones is an idea that kind of came from this. And frankly, the reason we did it is we kept looking at launch vehicles and how they stack commercial satellites on them. We kept noticing these little spaces they weren't using and asking if we could, you know, put things there if we showed up on the right day and time and help them not have to fly ballast. One of the interesting little details is early launch vehicles, rockets, didn't have very sophisticated control systems either. So if they were designed to boost a particular mass to a particular orbit, they launched with that amount of mass no matter what the satellite weighed. And, you know, we're a whole lot happier flying small satellites than flying lead, but that's another story. This is kind of what they look like. It was a 9-inch cube with a whip at the top, four blade antennas at the bottom, typically a 2-meter whip on top and 70-centimeter wavelength whips on the bottom. The ones on the bottom are the ones that are made out of that flexible measuring tape material. Actually, the top whip was too. And the ones on the bottom are the ones that were painted so that they'd cause this thing to spin a little bit. And in the four corners, the things that held the stack of five aluminum trays together were bar magnets. And there was a single bolt down through the center of the stack holding it all together and going through a compressed spring for the release mechanism. Wonderfully simple, passive attitude control design. These things work marvelously. Again, going back to the processing thing, this was the processing cluster for one of those, three circuit boards. Those cables were not the geometry that was used in flight. This is for integration. Actually, the Kapton ones over here probably were, because these boards all kind of got flipped and interleaved to fit into the one tray. To be honest, I don't remember exactly how all this went together. It's been a bunch of years. The bottom board, though, is interesting because that was the memory board, this big, huge bank-switched memory board to provide the RAM disk. It's appropriate to be talking about this because this board was made to work through the graces of some engineering folks and some facilities in a tiny little startup here in San Diego that was called Qualcomm. And this was the first time that AMSAT ever flew a really heavy-duty surface mount board. Since then, almost everything we've done has been surface mount, but it's kind of interesting how these things have evolved. And this is what one of these things looked like. This was Oscar 19 in its prepared for launch state. You can see the solar panels tiled on each of the surfaces except the bottom and the antennas and so forth. I'm sorry these pictures are as lousy as they are. The problem is we didn't have 5-megapixel digital cameras back then. A lot of these honestly were Polaroids that somebody scanned later. So, you know, you get what you get. So let's fast forward a little bit. Phase 3D, the fourth satellite in the Phase 3 series, also known as Oscar 40 after launch. The biggest, baddest thing we ever built. Consumed years of my life, along with lots of years of lots of other people's lives. It took us over 10 years to build and launch. It cost somewhere around $4.5 million, and all of that was donations. Yeah, we really did raise $4.5 million for this project, approximately $30 at a time. It still boggles my mind. The AMSAT organizations around the world all joined together and worked really hard to make this happen, both from a human resource and technology standpoint and from a financial standpoint. It was going to be a three-axis stabilized satellite with a huge power generating capacity, like 750 watts. We were expecting to be able to run multiple high-power transmitters to keep it oriented so the antennas were always aimed at Earth, la-di-da-di-da. Unfortunately, as I already mentioned, it had a propulsion system incident not long after launch and never really completely lived up to its expectations. But some of the experiments that it flew are things that I was very involved in, and I'll show you some of the things that we managed to accomplish with those. This is the proof that things actually do get built in basements. This is my basement circa that time, and those circuit boards on the table are various pieces of the digital communications processor called RUDAC that flew on that spacecraft. And these are a couple of friends of mine from Colorado who come down and pile around. You can tell by looking at the laptops about what the vintage of that photo is. It's interesting, too, that Bob Deersing, who's sitting there typing away, has worked on the bootloaders for all of the satellites going back to about Oscar 16. And Jim White, who's bending over, has been one of the command stations for almost every small satellite that's been launched since then, amateur and commercial. This is Chuck Green working on a module. This is an example of the kind of boxes we build to put things in. This is part of a high-power transmitter module. This was for Oscar 40. Again, this one module is about as big and weighs almost as much as a microsat. This is an entirely different kind of project to work on. There's some things that we do to achieve the results we need when we have zero budget and so forth. This is actually a vacuum test chamber that was put together entirely with parts acquired from Skycraft Surplus in Orlando. There's a glass bell inside that wire cage up there. You take the styrofoam box down here in the corner and fill it with dry ice, and then the compressor down there can suck all the air out, and lo and behold, you can test whether things are going to work and what their thermal stability is going to be in a vacuum, in a little lab in Orlando. Another good example is when you got a big satellite like that monster sitting in the back there that's got sensors that need to be able to, detect when they're sweeping past the sun. It's kind of hard to take that whole spacecraft and spin it. But if you take a bicycle wheel off of some unfortunate AMSAT person's child's bicycle and you mount it on a little arm like that, put a little electric motor and put a piece of string around it, and then, I don't know if you can see over there, but there's a piece sticking up that's actually got an automobile headlight element in there, and you get that thing rotating, the effect on the sensor on the spacecraft is just the same as if the spacecraft were spinning. Lots of kind of tricky little things like that to cheat and get around, what you might want to do otherwise. This is a picture of the kind of stuff that's in the bays of this hexagonal satellite. On the left side, that's the X-band transmitter, which unfortunately was one of the victims of the incident. But the reason I put this photo in is that little green circuit board over on the right, it's a reset and power control board for the two commercial GPS receivers we flew. And that's the board that has my solder joints on it that work perfectly in orbit. So, I mentioned vacuum testing. These are the solar panels for that satellite. They're big. And they needed to be run through vacuum to make sure that all of the chemicals and so forth that you use in the manufacturing process had a chance to outgas before we launched, and they outgassed and coated camera lenses and things like that. The folks at Orbital Sciences in Maryland allowed us to use their facility for this and the main spacecraft to do that thermal vacuum testing. This is Oscar 40 sitting on a shake-and-bake table at the Goddard Space Flight Center. Yes, even when they're like this big, you still got to shake them. That thing it's sitting on is a lot like the voice coil in a loudspeaker. And they, in fact, can run this all the way through the audio range. You don't want to be anywhere nearby when it's being shaken. we discovered that if you put Loctite on ceramic spacers, bad, bad, bad idea. But one other little detail that kind of stands out in this picture, you see that circular kind of pan-looking thing on the upper left? That's actually a short backfire antenna for the 23-centimeter amateur band. And that particular aluminum piece is cake pan, bought at a commercial kitchen supply store for about $12. It's a heck of, it was almost the perfect size, and it's another example of, you know, materials come from where you find them. This is that same satellite in Kourou, French Guiana, undergoing final integration and testing before launch on Ariane 507. The goofy-looking dude back there in the blue hat that's too tight is me. I spent a week there. The security folks loved it. They were all lined up one morning after a meeting when I came into the office wanting to shake my hand. I looked at them kind of funny and asked why. And it turns out the security guys and their camera system, among other things, can gauge the size of objects that they're looking at. And they said, we've never met a two-meter man before. So I got to tell you, they didn't have clean room gear for a two-meter man either. That thing hurt. Well, never mind. That's not... I could tell you all sorts of stories, but I won't. And the obligatory, boy, my head hurts, and it's not just because of the hat picture. And that's the box that I was really working on. This is this RUDAC communications processor. I'll talk a little bit about the details of what's in that, but that one module had over 29,000 hand-soldered solder joints in it, over 630 pieces of fastener hardware. That one module was the single most complicated thing ever built by anybody in the amateur satellite community, never mind satellites. And this satellite, every time I think about this project, the incredible number of man hours that went into this, sitting at the launch facility cafeteria over lunch and hearing two guys that had been part of this project have a 45-minute discussion about what the appropriate size drill bit was to use for venting the aluminum honeycomb panels, where you put glue around the edge to seal the panel, but then you got to provide a way for the air in the honeycomb to vent so that it doesn't, you know, burst when it's in a vacuum. I had this little epiphany that if there were people who could spend 45 minutes talking about the right drill bit size to use and hole spacing to use for that, all of the 30-odd modules in the spacecraft, all the different systems, all the different pieces of knowledge and human resource that had to come together to make this thing actually work are just impossible for me to comprehend. And here it is, once again, you know, getting ready for launch. This gives you some sense of where it got mounted. That's us, AMSAT P3D. It says 646 kilograms. We snuck a little extra fuel in. They kind of let us do that. But the big thing on top, that was the largest commercial communication satellite ever delivered to geostationary orbit. It's called PASS-1R, which stands for Pan-AMSAT 1 Replacement. This was the satellite launched as a replacement for the Pan-AMSAT satellite that we had launched Oscar 13 with. Turns out that's really fortunate because they had an incredible amount of money invested in this satellite. It was another one of those borderline, you know, bet the company on it deals. And when their chief financial officer saw that not only would we be mounted below them, but our 400 Newton kick motor would be aimed straight up at them, he kind of had a conniption fit. And the founder of the company said, oh, no, you don't understand. They're our lucky charm. I mean, they launched a satellite with the one that this one's replacing, and we'd love to have them fly with us. And so it was on the basis of that prior success that they took a deep breath and let us launch with them. And it was a perfect launch. Arianespace put that thing within 1 kilometer of the targeted 30,000-kilometer apogee, which in the rocket business is just stunning. This is that collection of small satellites being put on the top of the Ariane 5. This doesn't look all that fancy, but it's actually up at the very top of that vertical integration building. And that is our Ariane 5, Ariane 507, being rolled out to the launch pad. There's some things that the French do a little differently from NASA that just impress me. The thing that's holding that launch vehicle onto that launch platform is gravity. It's just sitting there. There are no structures holding onto it, no big explosive bolts and clamps that have to fly away. It just sits there until it goes. Those things you see draped across are hoses and wires and stuff, nothing sophisticated. And I don't know if you can see down there, but on the front side of that, there's something that looks kind of like the front end of a tractor trailer truck. It's because that's kind of what it is. They have this thing on these sort of parallel railroad track things, and they can move that launch vehicle from the vertical assembly building to the launch platform area in 45 minutes. And so their strategy for dealing with severe weather, should it ever come by there, is no problem. Our forecasters are certainly good enough to give us 45 minutes warning. We'll just roll it back. It's an entirely different situation than what you see at some other launch facilities. those towers around, and by the way, they launch from that same transporter. They roll it out, they light the fuse, and it goes. They have two of those transporter platforms so they can be stacking the next one while they're repairing the previous one. The four towers around there are for lightning protection. Nothing else. And this is what it looks like when you get a really successful night launch. That was just one of the coolest moments of my life. Because Pan AmSat was one of the customers, because they have lots of satellite transponder space, they actually broadcast this live around the world through their satellite network. And my kids and I sat on the floor of my living room in Colorado watching this over a slightly fuzzy but not bad C-band TV feed. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it wobbles. The way this works is there's this main engine called the I don't want to give you a lecture on the Ariane 5, but there's a big liquid-fueled main engine, and it lights off. And as it's coming up to thrust, it can't lift the launch vehicle, but it can take most of the weight off of it. So when they light off the SRBs, the sort of momentum delta, you know, this is where my physics starts to fall apart, but the stress at that moment is much reduced because the main engine's already lit up and is already trying to lift the thing. I actually was there for the launch of Ariane 506, but I was in a car on a road between the airport in Cayenne and the launch facility with Jim White. We were driving as fast as that little car would go, trying to get to where we could, you know, have a good view, because we had no idea what to expect. And all of a sudden, Jim, who had his watch, said, if they're going on time, you need to stop now. So I pulled over the side of the road. It's this long, straight road in the middle of, you know, rainforest kind of jungle. We went around back, grabbed our cameras, and as I was closing the hatch, all of a sudden on the horizon, we saw this glow in the low-lying clouds. And then we saw the launch vehicle. And I got to tell you, a night launch, if you ever have a chance to watch a night launch of a vehicle with as much thrust as an Ariane 5, drop everything else. Well, maybe show up for your wedding, but drop almost everything else and go, because I can't tell you, you know, watching that thing come up over top of us, I got to watch the solids separate. I mean, that was optically visible. It's just beautiful. Okay, well, going back to processor things, there were a lot of processors on Oscar 40. The IHU was based on this rad-hard version of the 1802. It turns out Harris had done some radiation-hardened versions for Sandia many, many years ago, and we got a couple of tubes of them, and Oscar 40 was just about the last of them. So not just because we need more processing power, we had to come up with something new for the future. But we actually had a donation of 64 kilobytes of silicon on sapphire RAM. When you do silicon on insulator like that, you get amazing radiation hardness, and so that IHU wasn't going anywhere. The sense of magnitude of damage done by the propulsion system incident is that that processor went through a full power cycle. The main bus voltage got crowbarred. Lots of other stuff, an experimental IHU based on a strong arm. RUDAC was actually a derivative of the processor design in the microsats in particular. It was very similar to the design that was done for Oscar 27 using a V53, which is a sort of an upgraded version of the V40 that we'd used on the microsats. The V53 is like an 8086 with EMS memory, for those of you who remember that far back. It knows how to bank switch 16 megabytes of memory, even though it only has a 1 meg address space. The really impressive thing there is we had 16 of these analog devices, 16-bit fixed-point DSP chips. They sucked a lot of power, but had we had a more successful operational lifetime, it would have been a lot of fun doing modulation encoding experiments with those DSPs. There were two camera assemblies done in Japan that had 68K flavor CPUs on them, three CAN-LAN smart node boards with a particular variant of the 60HC11 that's one of the only two that's fully static in its design. In other words, it doesn't have little bits of memory that control its configuration, it just has a lot of pins. There's this thing called Monitor, which was an RF analysis box that we never really got to use because the antenna for that was coiled up behind the solar panels, which we never had the guts to unfurl because we'd sustained an explosion and nobody knew what the state of them was. CEDEX was this radiation monitoring experiment. It had a couple of 8051 flavor parts in it, and there were two commercial GPS receivers, and I don't really know what they had in them. Those were Trimble TENS vector receivers. Maybe somebody around knows what was in those. So the GPS experiment, this is actually what got me personally involved in Oscar 40. These are some of the patch antennas that we flew. The reason the GPS experiment was exciting is that phase three satellites in the AMSAT parlance have these elliptical orbits that take them way out past the altitude of the GPS constellation at Apogee. And we always had this question of the GPS designers and developers of, you know, is there any intentional outward radiation from the GPS constellation that would allow, for example, the NASA GOES folks doing geostationary satellites to use GPS as a means of determining their orbit and orientation? And the official answer from the Air Force was, we won't tell you. And so, you know, being good amateur freedom-loving kind of folks, we said, no problem. We'll fly a satellite out there and measure the antenna patterns. So even though these were commercial receivers that didn't really have the firmware we'd like, we were able to demonstrate in several experiment runs, there's a five-minute window where we were sort of tracking four satellites and could have generated a navigation fix. However, because this satellite ended up being spin-stabilized, since we never got to unfurl the panels and go into three-axis stabilization, you'll notice that the signals up there are sort of dotted lines. That's because the patch antennas were being blocked by the nozzle, you know, the thruster nozzle, as the spacecraft spun. So the receivers that we were using were never actually able to generate a navigation fix, but the experiment showed through the collection of this data that if we'd had a spin-stabilized satellite, or if we hadn't had that big honking nozzle blocking the antennas, we could have navigated using GPS from the orbit that we were in. But this is the one that I just love. This is a picture of what the shape of the radiation pattern is from the antennas on the GPS constellation. We were able to confirm that there is no intentional outward radiation from the GPS satellites, but we're also able to confirm that it is possible to get enough signal to navigate by listening to the GPS satellites that are sort of on the other side of the Earth, and are, you know, they're being blocked by the Earth, but there's enough signal coming around. The reason for this is that the way the GPS constellation works is they'd like each satellite to have a relatively uniform signal strength at the receiver. So they have an antenna pattern where instead of the sort of traditional, you know, goal of maximum gain in the center of the pattern, they instead have one that pulls a dimple back in the center so that, you know, the signal strength around the Earth is relatively uniform. This means that the bulk of the energy is actually aimed right at the limb of the Earth. So if you're out on the other side of the Earth listening to those signals, they're actually bodaciously strong and more than enough with good preamps. Well, you know, 95 dB of preamp gain, it's not trivial, but it's possible to do. And I loved when this paper got presented and won a best of session talk award at the Institute of Navigation Satellite Nav Conference. Radiation measurements. This is like the second coolest thing that happened on OSCAR 40. What you're looking at there is, in effect, radiation intensity is a function of how many Earth radii out you are in the orbit. And that big hump on the left is what we know as the Van Allen belt, or the nearest Van Allen belt. It's this sort of region, you know, spherical region of greater radiation intensity around the Earth. The exciting part is that second little hump. It turns out only one satellite previously had ever observed that, and they thought it was an instrumentation anomaly. It turns out it's not. When there's been recent solar flare activity, there's an excitation of another energy level in the radiation belts around the Earth, and this was sort of just enough data to convince people that maybe that's a real effect. Unfortunately, we lost the ability to use this particular module before we had a chance to do what they were talking about down in the lower right there. This satellite actually had a high enough apogee due to the accidental performance of the propulsion system that it got high enough. It was actually in the bow shock region where the solar wind is starting to be deflected around by the Earth's magnetic field. And we could have done some really interesting measurements up there, but it didn't happen. The scope cameras. If you're in Japan, this is the equivalent of a basement. These guys designed a couple of really stellar cameras. When you realize how long ago these were designed, like 15 years ago, they were 800 by 600 pixel, 24-bit color, using a lens structure that used no organic elements in the color separation, so there was no degradation over time. These cameras took some really beautiful pictures. Unfortunately, the satellite was spinning and not three-axis stabilized. So we had to apply a lot of software work to try and de-spin the images, but we did get some pretty pictures. That's North and South America. Unfortunately, it's not showing up as nicely on the projector as it is on my LCD, but we got some of the first whole disk color images of Earth since the Apollo program, and that was pretty cool, even though, you know, I wish we could have taken more and had more time to mess with that. Okay, quick run through of some recent launches, and then we'll wrap things up, and I'll talk a little bit about where we're going, then we'll wrap up, and I'll take some questions for a while. AMSAT North America Echo, this is the latest microsat that was launched. It's working beautifully. It became Oscar 51 on launch. One of the things I love about this launch and lots of the other microsatellites that have gone recently is they were launched on converted Russian ICBMs. you know, the guys that, you know, help you bolt this thing up don't speak much English, and it's kind of fun to see them bolting things other than nukes onto the heads of these launch vehicles. There's actually a bunch of little sort of container spaces. Each one of those would have been a nuke. These were MIRVs. And it turns out when they launch small satellites, they go in the opposite direction. They sort of head south from Plesetsk, whereas if they were launching, you know, in an attack strike mode, they'd go north over the pole. And every time we see one of these launch and turn south, there's just something that feels right about that. yeah. Yeah, they can, but if they're coming to hit us, they... Yeah, okay. Still, the point's the same. Our friends in India, I actually had a chance to meet the guys who designed this satellite when I took a business trip to HP's facilities in Bangalore a couple of years ago. Bangalore is also where the Indian Space Research Organization, or whatever ISRO stands for, is located. This was launched in May of 2005. And again, it's an international collaboration. One of the transponders on here was designed and built in the Netherlands. The rest of it was done in India. I haven't personally had a chance to play with this satellite, but supposedly it's working really well. And while it's a relatively low Earth orbit satellite, it's got analog transponders, so it can support multiple simultaneous users using traditional AM radio communications modulation schemes. Another recent satellite launched in October of this year is this thing called SSETI Express. This satellite has not had a very healthy life. It's had battery charge problems and is currently, I think, still trying to be recovered. But it served as a launch vehicle for three of these little 4-inch CubeSats. And you can kind of see on the right-hand side, there's sort of the little door that flaps open and then they get ejected one at a time. There's a lot of interest in the university community in particular in building really, really small satellites, partly because they're the kind of things a university team, undergraduates particularly, can wrap their brains around. They're at a level of sophistication and complexity that you can actually hope to do something with in 2, 3, 4 years. They're sort of affordable. And overall, you know, they're really interesting. Lots of us in the amateur satellite community are a little worried about the fact that some of them are getting launched into orbits where the lifetime of the orbit far exceeds the design lifetime of the satellite. And that means, you know, we're sort of adding to the space junk problem. The good news is that space is big, and it's not really as big a problem as you'd think. But still, it's exciting to have another satellite which, if they're successful in recovering it and figuring out what's wrong with the battery charge stuff, could provide another interesting communications capability for ham radio folks. And where are we going from here? Well, there are currently three satellite projects that I'm personally involved in, and so those are the ones I'll focus on. The first one is called Phase 3 Express, being done by our friends at AMSAT Deutschland. You'll notice from the artist's conception there that this is very much like Oscar 13. In fact, it really is like Oscar 13. We got the space frame for the satellite by going to the museum at the Phillips University in Marburg and cutting the spare one down from the ceiling where it had been hanging as a museum display. They'd taken some foam core panels and glued photographs of solar cells onto them and hung it up in the ceiling so it kind of looked like a satellite. And literally, when I went to the first design meeting, it was sitting on a tripod in the front of the room with these three pieces of piano wire hanging off of it where they'd been cut down from the ceiling by Carl Mainzer the day before. Why? Well, it turns out that the biggest time-consuming hassle in getting a new satellite approved for launch is going through the structural test and certification process. This is a known structure. ESA's already approved it. It was built at the same time using the same materials as Oscar Phase 3 A, B, and C, which included the very successful Oscar 10 and 13 satellites. And what's interesting is in the intervening time, with the march of technology and miniaturization of electronics, we can fly a communications payload on here that's almost as sophisticated as what was on Oscar 40, but in the much smaller Oscar 13 class bus. This is a really exciting thing, and they're hoping to have this launched in another year and a half or so. In order to support that mission and the other missions that are coming, we needed a new integrated housekeeping unit design. So we've designed a new housekeeping unit based on an Atmel variant of an ARM7 processor, which runs this thing called IPS32, which is you take IPS and you just sort of enhance it to be a 32-bit machine instead of a 16-bit machine. We need this kind of increase in processing power because one of these missions, Phase 5A, needs lots and lots of forward error correction. And unlike the big boys, NASA and the Deep Space Network and so forth, we can't run 50 megawatts of power into 70-meter dish. And as a result, we need to code the uplink, not just the downlink. It's really easy to do the coding side of most forward error correction schemes. It's really computationally expensive to do the decode. So the big boys use uncoded uplinks and awesome amounts of power to get the satellite to hear them once in a while, and they allow the downlinks to be highly coded and throw lots of processing power on recovering the telemetry on the ground. Our problem is we need forward error correction on the uplink because we're limited to about 1.5 kilowatts of transmit power, and most of us don't have 70-meter dishes in our backyard. We call this thing IHU3. The piece that I've worked on personally is this thing called CANDU, which is a CAN bus-based distributed I/O multiplexing scheme that provides a matching increase in I/O capability. In the original IHU design, for the number of analog telemetry points you had, you could sample one of those on each 20-millisecond tick. And there was sort of a round-robin scheme where you'd sample the different telemetry points and then generate telemetry frames. This design allows us to sample all of the telemetry points on each 20-millisecond tick. And this is important for some of the navigational things that we need to do. We'll see how this all works out. Right now, it's pretty exciting stuff. Design meeting in Marburg, the usual bunch of bearded dudes, not all of whom have beards anymore. But these are the two existing prototypes of the IHU-3 undergoing testing in the Seattle, Washington area. These are really small boards. They're nowhere near the size of the IHUs that flew on previous missions, which were a couple of boards about this big. These are fully surface mount, double-sided, high-density stuff. These prototypes have sockets in various places so that the field-programmable gate array stuff that's being used to condense a lot of the logic can be tested. We actually have found a vendor of triple-mode redundant radiation-hardened field-programmable gate arrays that looks like it's going to work out really well. We've flown some of those on previous missions quite successfully, so this will be their first really, really mission-critical test, but we're very optimistic about that. This is an example of the fact that even we don't get it right the first time. enough said. These are these little CAN bus widgets. That's a 15-pin connector the same size as like a joystick port on a PC kind of thing to give you a sense of scale. And what these do is they provide a completely standardized interface between the spacecraft command, control, and power buses to the individual electronics modules on the spacecraft. That row of 40 pins across the bottom provides a standard, you know, set of gazintas and gazautas and analog telemetry points and so forth for each of the electronics modules. That's the backside of them. Little 8-bit Atmel 8051 microcontroller with an integrated CAN transceiver. A little switch mode power supply. We have tested the bejesus out of these because this is an absolutely mission-critical component for all of the high-performance satellites currently being designed by AMSAT. One of the things I'm really thrilled about is it was a constrained amount of work. You know, this project sort of had a start and a finish, and we kind of know when we're done. And so I have the joy of having made a mission-critical contribution to three significant satellite projects, and I didn't have to commit 14 years of my life. This is an example of one of them being test fit into the circuit boards that will be part of a star viewing navigation camera. This thing will have a cooled CCD that allows it to take pictures of the star field and another ARM7 processor with a bunch of memory holding a database of bright stars so that it can figure out what the attitude and orientation of the spacecraft is by matching up what it sees with its database of what's out there. That's being done at University of Arizona, I guess, in Tucson. I'm never real sure. I've got the Arizona institution's names right, but it's the one that's in Tucson, and it's a reasonably exciting project for us because it's going to be another one of those components we hope we can use over and over on future spacecraft. This is a sensor electronics module, again, with one of the little CAN boards on it. This is pretty early prototype, though the Germans are much more willing to fly things with grass on them than we are, so who knows. This is that exact space frame I was talking about. The foam core had been peeled off, it had been cleaned up, and things were getting ready to be put on. Peter Gulzow on the left, the president of AMSAT Deutschland. Rick, the president of AMSAT North America. Moi and Herr Professor Dr. Carl Meinzer, who started AMSAT DL and the whole IPS and Phase 3 mission sequence years ago. In North America, we're also working on another high-orbit, Earth-orbiting satellite mission called Eagle. We're actually planning to build two of these spacecraft. The communications capabilities will be sort of a lot like Phase 3E, except instead of focusing on a lot of different bands of weak signal microwave communication, we're designing and building an onboard, fully digital C-band up, C-band down transponder that we think it's going to make it really easy to do digital voice stuff from the ground with really small, almost handheld kinds of gear. The really interesting technical design element of this, though, is with those flip-out solar panels on the side, we can have relatively uniform power generation through the whole 2 pi steradians of spacecraft attitude. This is a big deal because in the past, every amateur satellite has had to compromise between good solar illumination angles for the solar panels and having the antennas pointed at Earth. And so there have been seasonality issues where the geometry of where the satellite was in its orbit and where the sun was relative to the Earth meant that we had to off-point the antennas to maintain a reasonable power generation capability, resulting in this thing we call squint angle. And squint angle is elusive. People say, well, the satellite's up there, and it's close enough. Why can't I hear it? Why can't it hear me? Well, it's because you're on the side of the antenna pattern. And we really think it's going to make an operational behavioral difference that the users are really going to appreciate because of that ability. Still in the AutoCAD design phase, we are going to share a lot of components like the IHU and CAN modules, but there's been no metal bent for this yet. But this is the one I'm really excited about. Somewhere in the launch preparation sequence for Oscar 40, somebody observed that that space frame had enough fuel on board to leave Earth orbit. And in fact, if you take a little of the weight off of it, i.e. not fly more than one kitchen sink, that it not only had enough delta V to leave Earth orbit, but it also had enough to decelerate and be captured by Mars orbit.
Yes.
And so this is a design where instead of having solar panels unfurl like this, you have them fold up like sort of petals of a flower there. Instead of having this antenna farm of, you know, lots of different modes and so forth for the communications links, you put a single dish on the top of it. It's about a 2-meter dish. And you operate S-band up, X-band down, which is 2.4 gigahertz and 10-ish gigahertz for those of you that don't speak AMSAT band designators. And there's some interesting things that happen. When you're on the way to Mars, the direction you need to point for the antenna to be aimed at Earth and the direction you need to point for good solar illumination are approximately the same. So you kind of get away with this design. And we have done the communications link design, which has driven the IHU-3 hardware design so that we can maintain, on the high-gain antenna, 200 bits per second fully error-corrected over the maximum distance from Earth to Mars orbit with a 3-meter dish on the ground on Earth. And in recovery mode, using the Omni antennas, we can maintain 5 bits per second, fully error-corrected, using that same ground station. And the Germans have gotten access to a one each 20-meter and 30-meter dish that were surplus by the government that have been taken over by ham radio clubs and are currently being used for radio astronomy experiments and so forth, which will be made available to be the primary ground station. So this is, like, less implausible than you might think. And the orbit's kind of interesting. What you do is you get put into a highly energetic geostationary transfer orbit around Earth. This requires the Ariane 5 with a higher capacity upper stage. It's the only launch vehicle right now that can get you into a sufficiently energetic orbit. At just the right moment, you do a motor burn that causes you to leave Earth orbit and enter solar orbit. And if you get the right solar orbit, you happen to be in the right place as Mars is coming by to flip around, do a decelerating burn, and therefore be captured by the gravitational field at Mars and end up in some hopefully reasonable Mars orbit. You get this opportunity about every 2 years. There's another opportunity in 07 and a really good one in 09. Takes about 9.5 months to get there. This is the lowest energy, delta V energy transfer orbit. What's really interesting is most of the nasty radiation stuff is in the Van Allen belts around the Earth, where this stuff's been captured and concentrated. The radiation environment, once you leave Earth orbit until you get out and into Mars orbit, is really pretty benign. So it's a really interesting project, and we'll see how it works. I asked Carl Meinzer, the project lead on this once, what happens if we screw up the, got to arrange it within about a kilometer to get the deceleration burn right, and it misses Mars and keeps going. And he laughed and, in a very thick German accent, said, "We'll set a new amateur radio distance record every day." But there are actually people that have even crazier ideas. The German branch of the Mars Society is building a weather balloon injector for us to fly so that they can do an injection of a instrumentation payload that hangs under something like a weather balloon, dropping it down from Mars orbit into the Martian atmosphere. I have no idea if this will work or not, but if it did, wouldn't that be incredibly cool? And the intention is that this would have a transmitter probably on the 50 megahertz-ish, 6-meter amateur band, which would transmit up to our satellite, which would then log all the data and turn around and send it to Earth over the X-band downlink.
Does that constitute still under FCC regulations?
God, I hope not. The question is whether that's still under federal communications regulations, and I really hope not. If you want to learn more about this, AMSAT.org has the complete history, lots more detail about all these spacecraft than I possibly could have time to talk about. AMSATDL.org is the German sister organization site. That's where all the Phase 3E and Phase 5A Mars mission stuff is located. Their web content tends to be a little thinner than the North American one, but that's okay. If you want to get an amateur radio license, go to ARRL.org. That's the American Radio Relay League. They have lots and lots of stuff about how to get a ham radio license so you can play. But whether you choose to do that or not, please go check out AMSAT, join AMSAT, give us a few bucks, and help support the future of the amateur satellite program. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions, please come up to the mics in the middle. Oh, come on. Somebody has to have questions. Please identify yourself first.
I'm John Stoffel. On your IHUs, do you have what kind of reset do you have if they do take a radiation hit? And have you thought about running sort of parallel cluster cloned ones where they watch each other, sort of thing?
Yeah. So this is the question's all about how we handle resets and redundancy. For all of the previous Phase 3 satellites and most of the LEOs, there's been a single processor in the center of it. For the LEOs, it's because you couldn't afford the mass and power for more than one. On the high-orbit satellites, it was the complexity versus redundancy trade-off. Carl Meinzer has this wonderful attitude that what's not in orbit can't fail in orbit. And this drives us to try and keep things really, really simple, straightforward designs, well thought out, clueful, well tested. And we complement this with hardware watchdog reset circuits. And on all of the previous satellites, we've used a hardware fire code detection thing where you send a particular bit sequence that is not normal, it's an out-of-band bit sequence, and that's used to trigger a reset circuit. One of the interesting things about all of those 1802-based IHUs is that none of them had any memory at all. And they use, in effect, I don't know how many of you know the 1802, but it has this wonderful pseudo-DMA mode where you can reset it. It sets a certain register's pointer to zero. Then you can put data on the bus and whack a line, and it'll store it in that location in memory and then increment the pointer. It makes it really easy to upload from the ground a 256-byte block and then say, go. And now you're running a tiny little bootloader that knows how to load more blocks. And so those IHUs flew with zero RAM, no ROMs or anything. Most of the microsats had a 2K x 8 fused link PROM made by Harris that contained, a really tight little bootloader that was used, and that was the only thing that had to work. For the IHU-3, the problem is that we can't it won't be able to hear our uplink commands unless the forward error correction decoder is running. So this one is different. It's got a flash memory part that's been heavily successfully used on previous missions, and it's actually going to fly with, you know, full up software stack on it that we can update from the ground. But the expectation is if that one takes a watchdog reset, it just reboots and runs from flash. Nothing like betting your life, but, you know, what do you do? Yeah, it's worked for a lot of stuff.
Back, Mike?
Mike Jones, Microsoft and USENIX. I've got two completely different questions.
Okay.
One is, how do you get the goodwill to be part of the weight budget and the risk budget for a commercial or government launch?
So in the early days, it's because they were flying ballast, and replacing ballast with us wasn't a big deal. It also helped that the primaries were, you know, super secret double black diamond, you know, spy satellites. And it was kind of nice to have this, you know, bunch of geeks building something in their basement as a media distraction. I don't think any of us really knew that at the time, or at least the guys who did know were smart enough not to talk about it. But some of the Corona satellites had AMSATs as secondary payloads that took all the media attention away. In more recent times, we pay for it. We are the victims of our own success. When we flew the microsats, the way we were able to afford the launch is that we found a place that hadn't been used before. And that little washer-shaped, you know, platform that went around there that had those little square satellites on it, we designed that. And Arianespace gave us an engineering credit for doing, for no charge, the engineering, construction, and certification work on that platform for auxiliary payloads, which became part of their catalog and allowed them to generate more revenue from commercial secondary payloads. And so that launch was almost free, though nothing's ever really free. We did have to pay integration expenses, which were to the tune of something like $40,000 US for each of those four satellites. For the Oscar 40 launch, that was booked as an $8 million launch. But again, that structure that it was sitting inside of, that sort of cylindrical extender to take the mating cone and elevate it to make that space in there, we designed that, we tested it, we certified it and delivered it to Arianespace, and it's now part of their catalog that they can sell to other people. And so at the end of the day, you know, mumble, mumble, $1 million exchanged hands, and it was substantially less than what the book value of that launch would have been. But the reality is today we get to buy launch space just like anybody else. We often can work some kind of a preferential deal, but yeah, it ain't free.
And if you fly the Mars mission, what types of instrument payload do you expect to have?
Frankly, not a whole lot on the main spacecraft because mass is a really big issue. To have any kind of ability to recover from oopses in the propulsion sequence, you'd like to have the lowest mass you possibly can. Having said that, there will definitely be the star camera things on there, which, if aimed at something other than stars, will take pictures of things other than stars. But I honestly don't know what other instrumentation we would be flying on that. Right now, my attention is purely focused on helping to deliver these housekeeping and command and control bus components that are being used for the 3E and Eagle missions, which would, if they prove out on those missions, be the core for the 5A as well.
Thank you.
Sure.
Tech Squidworth, Kilo Golf 6 Alpha Tango Hotel. Assuming that it makes it to Mars, and at the moment you've got a little better record than NASA does.
Now, be nice.
I'm trying.
Even if it is true.
How long is this bad boy going to last once it gets to Mars?
Well, if we don't blow it up between here and there, it ought to last a good long time. Oscar 40 was designed for, you know, sort of a guaranteed 10-year lifespan. And, you know, our experience with things like Oscar 7 and so forth suggests that if you don't screw stuff up, there's no reason these things can't work sort of indefinitely. You do have cumulative radiation dose effects on the electronics. But honestly, we don't have a whole lot of data about what that environment's like in Mars orbit. So, shrug.
And I gather that NASA's actually having problems with radiation killing their batteries.
Look, if we successfully drop that thing into any Mars orbit, I will declare victory, we'll buy a good old bottle of scotch and have a party.
Well, whatever they do this time, don't let them leave the plug sitting in the cone when they launch.
Yeah. I actually have a question.
Sure.
How much of what you've done and discovered have you given back to NASA and said, here, you guys use this?
Everything we do is published. And in fact, for the Eagle mission, we are doing the design of the spacecraft in an open source kind of way. I introduced this amazing new novel concept to AMSAT about 3 weeks ago called the Wiki. And, well, you know, look, I mean, these are really nice guys. They're some of the smartest people I've ever worked with, but most of them are retired, you know, military and aerospace guys. And, you know, email they've kind of wrapped their brains around. But wikis were a new idea. They're all completely sold on the idea now that they've seen it work. We've actually got an instance of the media wiki stuff running on one of the AMSAT servers now. We call this thing Eaglepedia, and it's loaded up with all of the design docs so far on Eagle. If you go troll around the AMSAT.org website, it's not very well linked in yet, but it will be soon.
Back, Mike?
Charles McDonald. I was sitting way in the back, and I couldn't see the slide that you had that measured the radiation. What were the labels on the axes there?
The horizontal axis was a number of Earth radii out, you know, distance away from the Earth, and the vertical axis, if I remember correctly, was a proton event density. If you'd like, I'll be happy to pull that up after we're done with the Q&A, and you can stare at it a little more if you'd like.
Okay, thanks.
The entire slide deck will eventually end up on gag.com, which is my website. Should be findable eventually.
Front mic.
Hi, Steve Johnson with the State of Arkansas. As much as you can talk about, I heard you say there's like one ground station for, you know, for majority of the satellites. But could you talk about the ground stations, maybe a little bit about the control protocols, and how do you prevent someone from hacking?
So the good news is there's not a whole lot of incentive to hack something that was built by volunteers and is sort of, you know, amateur radio grade communications. It's not nearly as much fun as, you know, putting porn on the screens of everybody watching HBO, which isn't hard to do. but the reality is that the command uplinks are coded. If you look in the amateur radio rules from the FCC, there is one exception to the thou shalt not encrypt and obscure communications, and that is for the control of amateur satellites and other control functions, which people have been meaning to say it's okay to use it for repeater control links and so forth. But the amateur satellite uplinks are, they do have keys involved in them, and so you'd have to actually be close enough to one of the command stations when they were sending important commands to be able to listen to what they were sending and try and reverse engineer it, and that's sort of nesting a bunch of improbabilities. There are, for each of these satellites, a relatively small number of command stations, but every user of the satellite is, in effect, an operational ground station. I can sit in my house and talk through all of the currently operational satellites using the privileges afforded by my amateur radio license. The amateur satellite spectrum and the amateur radio spectrum overlap. So anyone with an amateur radio license can transmit in the right place to be heard by the satellite, which transmits in the amateur satellite service. And that's how that kind of works. For the future, we're moving to a slightly more sophisticated command uplink encoding mechanism simply because we think we should. Not because we've had any evidence that what we're doing now is bad, but I'm personally a complete non-fan of security through obscurity, even though in this case it's been pretty effective.
Okay, last question. Back, Mike.
Andrew Cowie, VE9AKI slash, well, whatever the hell they are down there. You characterized the radiation environment on a transplanetary orbit as relatively benign. Now, I grant the qualifier there, but I know people get all sick in the Van Allen belts, but I'm sort of surprised to hear you say that because most of the concern around a manned Mars mission seems to be around radiation, especially flares and
storms.
So
there's a really big difference between the effects of ionizing radiation on living tissue and the effects of ionizing radiation on silicon-based semiconductor devices.
Well, I don't know. You drop a coffee on my leg, I'm fine. You drop a coffee on my laptop, it's going to be in real trouble.
Yeah. Works the other way in the case of radiation. So at the end of the day, it's the it really is a question of understanding what the effects of cumulative dose are, because all of the other effects are the same no matter where you are. And the trick there is to do appropriate shielding. We do all kinds of strange little things that we can't really prove are the right things to do, but which we have empirical evidence to suggest, you know, seem to work, like taking little pieces of tantalum and covering them with Kapton and gluing them down on the top of major ICs. We do things like when we're laying out these double-sided surface mount boards, we try to put sort of matching geometry important ICs back-to-back with each other so we can sort of shield both sides and do the sandwich thing. Most of the important electronics is relatively central in the spacecraft, and there's a fair amount of aluminum outside of there. And it really, you know, this is one of those, it depends on so many axes. Anyone who claims that they completely understand what's going on in the radiation environment on one of these spacecraft is just either naive or lying through his teeth. But, you know, operational experience suggests that the kinds of things we tend to do tend to result in circuits that last a good long time. So hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, we'll keep being lucky. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your attention.
Thank you all.